Tens of thousands of Australians are reported missing each year, and while most of these people are found in a short period of time, some are not. When Dan O'Keefe disappeared in 2011, the lives of his family were changed forever. They felt unsupported by police and spent years searching for him. Dan's sister, Lauren O'Keefe, is now a leading voice for families affected by long-term disappearance, and she's founder of what's known as the MIST Foundation. Lauren O'Keefe, welcome to Changing Australia on Radio National Breakfast.
Thank you for having me.
For people who haven't had this experience, how would you tell people about the most difficult aspect of having someone who's missing for a long time? Because at the beginning, you don't know that it's going to be a long time.
Exactly. So I think most people have had that terrifying experience where they might be in a crowded place and for just a few moments they've lost sight of their child, or maybe it's their pet, and there's that sheer panic, you know, utter desperation. So imagine if those few moments extended into an hour or a week or a year or a lifetime. So it's that literally being worried sick, and then on top of that adding in, you know, the thousand new things that you suddenly need to learn and do and navigate. You know, you've got the burden of media pressure, there's the public scrutiny, you're liaising with police, you're up against all sorts of administrative obstacles. You know, you can't close your loved one's accounts if you don't have a death certificate. There's the financial impact of searching, and then of course the psychological distress. So longer term, what starts as an acute stress disorder, you know, your nervous system is completely overwhelmed, there's all of that adrenaline. If your loved one remains missing, you enter into this space of long-term urgency. Mm-hmm. And it's a very complex type of grief. It's called ambiguous loss. And it's considered to be the most traumatic type of loss and the most unmanageable form of stress because, you know, there's that continual nature of it. It's agonizing because our brains are hardwired to create stories. Mm. And so we're trying to fill these gaps in knowledge. So we've got all of this imagined trauma of what's happened alongside all of the theories that strangers are offering up, you know, online or even to your face. You've got the social isolation of the experience itself. And then there's this very palpable disillusionment caused by the expectations set by Hollywood. You know, police don't actually have those resources that we see on TV and in the movies. So it's an all-consuming, exhausting, relentless experience.
Lauren, I'm wondering, with those longer-term disappearances, when you don't know where the finishing line may be, how do you honour and fight for your loved one, but also try to get on with life when there is no finish line there, as far as you know?
It's really difficult, and it's case by case. You know, I was very fortunate in that I was able to drop everything and make, you know, my sole focus around the search for my brother. That the privilege of being able to do that is not lost on me. Most people have to return to work. You know, they've got mouths to feed, they've got commitments, they have to manage to somehow live a semblance of a normal life alongside this constant pressure of trying to find their loved one, that all-consuming worry. But we know from research on ambiguous loss that the best way of coping with it is to make meaning out of it. So that's a key focus of the work that our organisation does, is trying to create opportunities for families living in this space to make meaning out of it, you know, contribute to projects and initiatives and research that's going to address the bigger picture and, you know, provide solace for other families out there who are living with it.
I bet that's even harder than it sounds, Lauren.
It is. It is. It's very complex. And again, it's really case by case. Some families are driven to spend all their nights and weekends out there searching, you know, ground search in the weeds. You know, other families feel as if they've done absolutely everything they can. And then again, they somehow have to manage the day to day with the not knowing. And that's why, you know, it's so important that we do create these tools, these therapeutic resources to help people survive the unending not knowing.
What was the relationship like with the police in your case when your brother went missing?
It was difficult because what we see on TV isn't the reality. Dan was an adult male. There were no suspicious circumstances. We were not afforded any police resources. At least that's what we, you know, that's what we believe to be the case. That's how it felt. And that's what prompted us to turn to the public. So we have these expectations. So I think it's really important that police from the very beginning set realistic expectations for what families can expect to receive from them. I think across the board, communication from police is a really difficult component of the relationship for families because, understandably, police don't want to tell a family there's been no new information, but we still need to hear that there's been no new information because it shows us that our loved one hasn't been forgotten. And with the absence of that news, we feel as if they have been forgotten, and that's really distressing for families. And I also think the fact that there's a lack of uniformity across jurisdictions and even within, you know, there's very much a front desk lottery, it feels, for families, you know. So it's really hard to see that there are different responses in regards to, you know, risk assessments or search resources that police are, you know, spending or reward money, as well as processes for inquests. You know, there's that real lack of consistency, and it's hard for families to see that.
What does the evidence tell you? You were talking a little bit about, you know, having some meaning in this whole experience. What does evidence tell you about what else might be helpful for people if a loved one is missing?
It's such a broad issue. There is such a breadth of intersections. You know, people go missing for Australia. In Australia, at least, it's 85% of cases pertain to mental health. Mm-hmm. But then there's dementia, there's misadventure, there's natural disaster, there's migration, there's conflict, there's foul play, and everything in between. So it's a really broad space. And due to that, the diversity of resources and contacts and actions and methods of support for families is going to really differ. And our organisation is always guided by what the families wish to do and have the support that they need at that moment, because it does change over time. In the beginning, you all just hope that your loved one's going to walk back through the door and life will go back to normal. But after years or decades, you might hope that there's resolution so that, you know, you can die and know that the burden of search isn't going to be passed down to the next generation. So hope does look different to everyone. It's valid no matter where you are and how you feel. It's very malleable. And I think families need to have that permission to feel those things and express these really complex thoughts and feelings that they feel as if no one else can possibly comprehend, which is why offering them that safe space and fostering that that sense of belonging. I mean, no one ever wants to belong to this group, but we're here and we need to exist, and we need to give that solace to others, because like with any trauma, the first step towards healing is knowing that you're not alone.
We were talking before about the finish line, which can be impossible to know, but is it also hard to know the start line, or in the way that you're dealt with, because so many people are found quickly, is there initially things that are not taken seriously, or you're not given the resources because it's fairly likely that someone's going to be found, whereas in fact it might be a case when someone has gone missing for a very long time?
Definitely, it's impossible to know. And that's why our foundation project is the Missing Persons Guide. So it's a website that's a step-by-step of what to do, very practical, simple, clear advice. You know, it's got a checklist of things that families can do. That guidance, because it's impossible to just sit at home and wait. You know, you've got to do something. Action is the antidote to despair. So we've got all of these sort of step-by-step tasks that families can do in those first days, maybe weeks, maybe months, because you don't know how long it's going to take. And then once it does become long-term, that three-month marker, at least in Australia, that's where, you know, the media interest has typically died off, therefore the public has lost interest. We've got ever-shortening attention spans here, and we're competing with an endless news cycle. So a lot of our work is really keeping these stories in the public eye, humanising these loved ones beyond, you know, the confines of a bloody police missing persons poster that reduces these loved ones to a few vital stats. You know, these people are a lot more than that.
It sounds like for you, Lauren, this work has been very meaningful, and there's been some nourishment from it. What's the cost, though, of being in this space and other people's tragedy in an ongoing basis?
I am very fortunate to have had resolution. Again, the privilege of that is not lost on me. I'm dealing with about, 90 different families across Australia who have very different sets of circumstances and thus challenges and needs. And I am constantly reminded of what it was like for those years that we had to exist in that space where you are just oscillating between hopelessness and hopefulness. But from that and now where I am, I have an incredible sense of purpose as well as responsibility for those aforementioned reasons. So it keeps me going, knowing that we are doing work that is valuable, despite the fact that we still have no funding from the Australian government or the corporate sector. We are still doing this work and, we're getting endorsements from world-leading organisations across Europe. We're getting academics that are praising the resources that we've created. I'm being invited to present at different conferences and symposiums around the world. And so that's what keeps me going. It is exhausting, but, this work is my brother's legacy. And so I am conscious of not burning out because I want to be doing it for the rest of my days.
If it's okay to ask you, Lauren, Dan, your brother, was found almost 5 years after he went missing. He'd taken his own life. It was interesting to hear you using the word privilege to have that resolution. How do you feel about getting that information? As awful as it was an answer to something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's the most devastating relief you can experience. The torment of ambiguous loss is finally over and you're allowed to grieve. You get to have those rituals. You can visit a grave, you can travel, you can sell your house, you can not feel obliged to spend every night and weekend searching, and the cortisol finally stops pumping and your brain can heal. So it's a privilege, but it is, devastating.
It's a very, very painful release from that process that you were in before. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there's an enormous relief that you're talking about, but is there loss also in finding that information, because you've been in this state of hyper alert, but also there's been some hope there. There might be a chance, and then that's taken.
Absolutely. That immediate and crushing loss of hope, the thing that had kept you going for those years. There are layers to this grief, and the loss of hope is a big one. You've got the grief that you've experienced whilst they've been missing and all of the imagined trauma that has occupied your brain in that time. And then you've got a whole new layer of grief, which is the permanent loss that they are deceased and you won't get to have that moment where they come back through the door. So it's devastating, and it's a really disenfranchised grief. A lot of people kind of switch off because it's too big to process. Loss, even when it's a standard loss, is difficult for people to talk about. So we are trying really hard to get the ambiguous loss into the vernacular around Australia. We're trying to upskill mental health professionals so that families do have specialised counselling out there, because it is quite complex.
Mm. Often, Lauren, we can be kinder to others than we are to ourselves. Have you reached a place where you can look back on the way that you dealt with that 5 years and the work that you continue to do, not only for your own family, but to knock on the door and try and change the systems that surround all of this? Can you see a sense of progress in the way that you've not only honoured your brother, but opened a hand to others as well?
Absolutely, I can. And when I allow myself the luxury of stepping back and looking at that, I do pat myself on the back, and I see, the gaps that are being filled by the work that our organisation is doing. There was no guidance when Dan disappeared. I asked police what to do and they said, do whatever you feel like you need to do. There was no support. Nothing existed. There was a huge stigma and taboo around the whole issue of missing persons. And I think that Dan really challenged those stereotypes, and through us, humanising him through largely the social media campaign, we brought this issue outside of those police sort of confines and into the mainstream. And we've created a space where people like our family back then, they can feel as if they belong. And again, like with any kind of trauma, in order to heal, you need to feel like you're not alone. You need to be able to connect with other people. And I'm really proud that we've created that space. There's a huge amount of work still to be done, but we've made progress. And this is, you know, this is where I'm going to be for the rest of my days.
Lauren, it's very generous to come and share your story and also to share some of this information for other families that may be going through this situation. There'll be some listening that will not know that they may be dealing with some of these issues in the future as well. Thank you so much for being my guest on Changing Australia today.
Thank you for having me.